Let's see, 12. We have here this sort of excursus, apparently, about Jacob and about his wrestling with God and how eventually he found peace with God. And we're told, and you also turn to your God. Well, the way to understand Hosea's prophecies, I think, are to understand that they are all somehow alluding to the real-life struggle between Hosea the prophet and his wife Gomer, the prostitute whom he married, who represented Israel. And of course, she was unfaithful to him, and they struggled in their relationship, of course. He was angry with her, he was furious with her for her adultery, and then he was very loving to her and offered her absolutely everything, by all means wanting to make the relationship work. Well, we don't come to the end of Hosea and read, and Gomer said to Hosea, I am terribly sorry. I have really messed you around. I have really been an awful woman. Will you please forgive me? And he says, of course, dear. Of course, that's what I wanted to do all the way through. And they lived happily together ever after. You don't have that. And you don't have that happy ending between God and Israel, I'm afraid. And yet the example of Jacob is raised, I think, because the idea is that here too was a man who struggled with God, but who came to reconciliation with God. And in fact, that struggle became part of the defining nature of the intimacy between God and Jacob. Well, you read in verse 2, I will punish Jacob according to his ways. But the same word is in chapter 4, verse 14, I will not punish them. This is just how Hosea thought about Gomer. I'll punish her. He even says, I will have you killed with the punishment for a prostitute because you've been a prostitute against me, even while you're married to me. But then he relents, and you find all these conflicted statements. As God says himself, how can I give you up, Ephraim? My repentings, my changes of mind are kindled together within me. He says, you will not go to Egypt. But then he says, you will go to Egypt. This is all reflecting the oscillation of Hosea's feelings about Gomer. You see how God, although he is almighty, so loves us that he relates to us within the frames of our own sort of understanding of time, and he has these passionate feelings within him. So he says here, I will punish Jacob according to his ways, according to his deeds. God will repay him. Well, yes, and yet God didn't do that. Just as Hosea thought of punishing Gomer according to what she'd done, and then he doesn't do that. He doesn't have her stoned to death. And Hosea's love for Gomer left him, I suppose, vulnerable and eager for every and any sign of genuine repentance. This is how it was with God and Israel, and this is, amazingly enough, how it is in his feelings towards us. He, in the end, as the Psalm 103 says, and often God did not punish Israel according to their sins. Yet here, God says he will. And there's many examples of this. You know, God says to Adam, in the day you eat the fruit, you shall surely die. But he doesn't. God is not the God of Islam, where he simply says something and it must happen. Where there are certain things to be obeyed, that's the deal. You don't obey them, well, you're going to be punished. If you do obey, well, you get good marks and you get tick and you accept it. God is not like that, because God is seeking relationship with people. Well, verse 3, talking about Jacob, in the womb he took his brother by the heel. Well, of course, Genesis 25 says that Jacob did this after they were born. Not in the womb, but after they were born. Jacob took his brother by the heel. It's not possible for a baby in the womb, enveloped in water, to grab hold of the heel of the twin sibling in the womb. And it's as if God sort of counts that to Jacob, as if, well, yes, I'll imagine that that's what happened. And this tiny baby, who is totally powerless and yet is seen as taking his brother by the heel, This is seen as Jacob's strength, because it goes straight on, and in his maturity, or in his strength, that's the word, that's what the Hebrew really means, and in his strength and his maturity, he had power with God. So this frail little baby who grabbed his brother by the heel just as they were born, and it's imputed to him as if that happened in the womb, when it didn't technically happen in the womb, this very weak power of a baby is seen as his strength. Well, in his maturity, or in his strength, he had power with God. Well, it's alluding to the incident where Jacob wrestles with God, and that night I think he does come to a big step up the ladder in his relationship with God. Don't forget, he had said at Bethel before he came to Laban, "If God will be with me, if he will bring me back to my father's house in peace, then Yahweh will be my God." A very skeptical approach. And now he wrestles with the angel, and they apparently are at a stalemate, but then the angel touches his sinew in his hip, and he limps, and that's it, game over. Just as easy as that. And yet here we're told that he had power with God. It's as if he won. Well, he didn't win. And yet, it's like he took Esau's heel in the womb. Well, he didn't. But it's all imputed to him. And, of course, that night his name is changed from Jacob to the heel catcher to Israel, which means both striver with God and prince with God. There's this play on words, the Hebrew word for striver, struggler, and prince is the same. And I think the idea is that, sure, he wrestled with God, but in the intimacy of that struggle, he comes very, very close as he's panting in the face of the angel, and the angel is apparently panting in his face. Sure, God can win. Just touch a sinew, and that's it, game over. But God continued, in order to bring him to be Israel, struggler, prince with God, and God counts him as if he won. He had power with God, or even over God. I think the idea is that the characteristic of Israel, and we are the new Israel, we are Israel after the Spirit, the characteristic of Israel is this struggle with God. And I think the idea is that God hasn't given us, for example, 10 or 20 ritual commands that you've got to go and obey, and if you do, all's good. He's looking for intimacy. He's looking for relationship. And so he allows people to disagree. He allows people to disobey, and yet he coaxes strongly towards obedience. And he will recalculate at times his plans with people in accordance with their behavior. And in that sense, you can have power with God. Think of all the times when God said he was going to do something, like destroy Israel and make of Moses a greater nation, but Moses struggled with God in prayer, and he wins, as it were. God even says to Moses, "Leave me alone, that I may destroy these people," as if he knows, yeah, I might change my mind if Moses really struggles with me. But Moses does struggle with him. So many times, you know, Nineveh, 40 days, Nineveh's going to be destroyed, no terms and conditions attached. And yet, the repentance of the Ninevites was their struggle with God, and he gave in, as it were. So many examples, the more you look for them. This is where the one true God is so different to all human conceptions of God. The only thing in which God does not change is in his grace. I, the Lord, change not. Therefore, you sons of Jacob are not consumed. That is the point at which he is unchanging. But he is very flexible, if you like, because he wants to get into this intimacy with people. And so as Jacob and the angel were like panting in each other's faces, they struggled and wrestled with each other, well, so actually so are we. And this is a very far cry from the denominational life where you learn truth as a youngster from mum and dad, and you join the denomination, And you go through your life with hearing largely pleasant platitudes on Sundays at meetings, the endless round of church attendance, no tears, little real sacrifice, realistic self-denial, realistic self-examination, daily struggle with issues. This is all somehow eclipsed by the institutionalized way of doing spirituality, which the whole thing of sort of standard religion brings with it. It's a very far cry from that. Now, I may have caricatured things, and it becomes increasingly apparent to me that people who I thought were like that, who just sort of drifted through their Christian experience, actually do have tremendous struggles with God. Just that I didn't get to know that, because you don't until you really get to know people and really talk with them and really come to understand where they're thinking and where they're at. And so I'm not saying we should resist God for the sake of it. Sure, of course not. But in reality, we do struggle with God. And that is how it is. Some people struggle over the problem of evil. Why this suffering? Why that? Just as Jacob struggled with his brother Esau, and he struggled with his father Isaac, I think. He struggled with Laban. And that angel represented all of them, I think. And he says to Esau that it was as if he had seen Esau's face in the face of that angel. So he struggled with both God and man. Verse 4, indeed, he struggled with the angel and prevailed, or as the AV says, he had power over the angel and prevailed. How can man have power over God, especially sinful, weak man like Jacob? But I think, therefore, what actually happened that night is that, the night of Jacob's wrestling, is that in the end he realizes who this is. This is an angel, and I'm fighting God, and this has been the story of my life. And he ends up pleading and begging the angel, and that's why the angel has to say to him, let me go, because the day's breaking. And I think why Jacob wouldn't let him go is that he's clinging onto him and begging him for forgiveness. And it was that which was granted. And that is the sense in which he had power with God and prevailed, that God said, okay, sure, I will give you what you ask for. And that's why it says he struggled with the angel and prevailed. He made supplication to him. He made supplication to him. He was begging him to be gracious to him. And that's why when he meets Esau and gives Esau these great big presents, he says, take away my blessing that I have given to you. And that's definitely the meaning of the Hebrew. Take away my blessing because I have all things and abound, because I have God's grace and acceptance. So that is all you need. He's alluding, of course, to how he had tricked Esau out of the birthright, how he had lied and deceived Isaac to get the blessing of the birth of the firstborn out of him. And he's saying, look, take it back, take it away, take the blessing. I don't want it, because I have all things. I have seen the face of God. I've been accepted. I've been forgiven. Material stuff doesn't mean anything to me anymore. Just take it and go. And, you know, he learnt that the night before by wrestling with the angel, by weeping, making supplication, looking for grace, and he's given it. And when it says that he made supplication to the angel, it is literally he sought for grace. And that is what he was given. And so he says to Esau, Genesis 33, that I've got all things. I've got God's grace. God has dealt graciously with me. Well, he got there by all the struggle, and yet also by giving up the struggle and just clinging on to the angel and begging for acceptance. And of course, the point of it all is, verse 4 at the end, and there he spoke with us, even Yahweh, the God of armies. Therefore, ought you also turn to your God. The idea is that Jacob there is every man, that Jacob is all Israel. And forget, whenever you read of the historical Jacob, you read of Israel. That was his other name. And so this is us. This man struggling with God. This man who is not particularly spiritual, who is not particularly obedient and complacent with God's will, but who clings on desperately for grace, who realizes how he's been. This is Israel. This is all Israel. We are Israel. This is absolutely the characteristic. Striver with God, struggler with God, prince with God. As I say, this is very far from the Sunday school Christianity idea that you believe a set of theology and you sort of drift on eagle's wings kind of half-consciously through your life and marry someone who does the same and raise your kids to do the same and, you know, it's all hunky-dory and all wonderful. No, it's not like that. It is, in real spiritual terms, if you are truly Israel, it's not like that at all.